You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
We understand your message, but some people ask themselves, will you be tweeting differently once you board the Air Force One? Thank you.
No, that's other people that do that. I don't. I'm very consistent. I'm a very stable genius. Go ahead.
That was President Donald Trump reiterating one of his most famous self-assessments during a press conference at the 2018 NATO summit. It's worth noting that Albert Einstein never called himself a genius. Stephen Hawking never called himself a genius. Isaac Newton never called himself a genius. Nor did Galileo, Da Vinci, Mozart, or Pablo Picasso. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill also never used the term genius in reference to themselves. But yes, Donald Trump, the man who won't allow any school he ever attended to release his grades and brags about his IQ but refuses to reveal his IQ score, assuming he ever took the test, this man is a genius. Aside from what that preposterously over-the-top statement, "very stable genius," says about the psyche of the man in the White House, it's also the title of a new book by Washington Post reporters Philip Rucker and Carol Lenig. And today, Phil Rucker, who also serves as Washington bureau chief for the Post, joins me on the podcast to talk about the book and share some stories from various White House staff that would seem to give lie to the supposed stability and genius of the man occupying the White House. These include the time Trump tried to overturn the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act so American businesses can bribe foreign governments, the time he wanted to turn a profit on the U.S. military by turning our troops into a mercenary force, and the Pentagon meeting where he called his decorated generals a bunch of babies and losers. Phil discusses the falling out between the president and his former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, how some world leaders have tried to turn Trump against his own advisors, and how the most powerful leader in the world solicited other heads of state for the Nobel Prize. Plus, we talk about impeachment, Trump tweets, Bolton, Mueller, and more, coming up with The Washington Post's Philip Rucker in just a moment. Philip Rucker is the White House bureau chief at the Washington Post, leading its coverage of President Trump and his administration. He and a team of Post reporters won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. Now he and his Washington Post colleague, Carol Lenig, have written a new book about the Trump White House titled A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Phil, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, the title of your book is a reference to sort of how Trump has described himself on more than one occasion. It's almost an absurd statement for any person to make, much less a president. And like many things with Trump, it seems to sort of hint at these deep insecurities that he might have. What does this title say about what you wanted to put out there in this book?
Yeah, so you're right that this is the president's own statement. And he first made it in January of 2018, about a year into his presidency. There was a national debate underway about his psychological health, his mental acuity, his very fitness for the office. And he said, you know what? I'm not only a genius, I'm a very stable genius. He then repeated it at least four additional times. And in selecting the title of the book, you know, Carol and I were not trying to mock the president. In fact, it's a deadly serious book full of rigorous reporting. But we wanted to use his own self-description, his own sense of his own of a self-image, and hold it up as a mirror to himself. So we stress test this phrase, and we interviewed more than 200 top administration officials and advisors to the president to really understand: is he a very stable genius? What is he like behind the scenes? And many of them, you know, illustrated for us that he is not.
And we're meeting today as it appears that the impeachment trial of Donald Trump is wrapping up and headed to a quick acquittal with no witnesses. Based on your research over the first 3 years of Trump's presidency, did anything about the Ukraine scandal come as any kind of a surprise for you?
You know, no, because it fits a pattern of behavior that we saw from the beginning of the presidency of a president who prioritized his own political and personal interests over the nation's security, a president who views himself, because he's the president, as somehow above the law and not subject to accountability, a president who doesn't necessarily respect foreign alliances and is willing to disrupt them. In this case, Ukraine has been a longstanding U.S. ally and counting on American support to form a bulwark against Russia and aggression from Russia. And Trump disregarded that recent history by withholding this military aid. And so it fits a pattern that's been established through what's happened publicly in the administration, but even more so through what we've documented with these exclusive interviews of the people who've worked with the president.
And a lot of the attention this week has been focused on John Bolton. You shed some light on the whole Trump-Bolton relationship in this book. The president apparently liked to joke that Bolton wanted to bomb everything and was kind of the crazy in the room.
He sure did.
Did he maybe even like having Bolton around because he maybe made Trump look a little bit more sane and calm by comparison?
That's exactly right, according to our reporting. You know, President Trump had admired Bolton for many years for his fiery interviews on Fox News, his commentary, and Bolton sort of understood Trump and was able to play to Trump's ego by praising the president's foreign policy decisions on TV as a way to earn status in the administration. Trump then hired him as national security advisor and used to joke to visiting foreign dignitaries and others in the administration that he likes having Bolton around because Bolton is going to turn your country into a parking lot. He's going to bomb everything. He's after World War III, World War IV, World War V. And you know, he would say it in a joking manner, but in all seriousness, he liked having Bolton as a contrast because he could cast himself, the president could, as somehow more moderate because there is such a more hardline, hawkish viewpoint that Bolton espoused. Trump could then present himself as the more reasonable middle-of-the-road ideologue when it comes to foreign policy.
And something that comes up a lot in this book is Trump's burn rate, not just with his White House staff, but also with his attorneys, and how difficult it's been for him to find any reputable lawyers who wanted to touch him. I think the Senate impeachment really highlights that point because two of his attorneys are Dershowitz and Starr, who have their own scandals.
Yeah, you know, they both have their own scandals in the past, but they're also television personalities to some degree and well-known for their cable news appearances, which is certainly appealing for Trump when he's looking at hiring people. We document in the book the period right after Robert Mueller is appointed the special counsel for the Russia investigation, and Trump has to suit up. He has to get a legal team together, and this is a truly existential threat to his presidency, the Russia probe. And he needed a strong defense, and he had a lot of trouble recruiting top-shelf lawyers. We describe how one after another he would reach out to these white shoe legal defenders in Washington with really high reputations, and they were turning him down for one reason or another. He ended up with Mark Kasowitz, his longtime New York attorney, who flamed out after a few months. And then, of course, we know he landed in the graces of Rudy Giuliani, and we see what has happened there over the last couple of years. But the president really struggled to get a credible legal defense team.
Mm-hmm. And you say in here that I guess Trump was genuinely scared when he got the news that Robert Mueller had been appointed as the head of the Russia investigation. This sort of goes against this perpetual machismo and confidence that he exudes, bordering on foolhardiness. Do you think that he was more afraid of Mueller or more afraid of impeachment?
You know, I think he was afraid of both. Mm-hmm. He's most afraid of losing power, of losing his office, and to the extent that Mueller posed a threat to his power, that created fear for President Trump. We have a scene, part of which was documented in the Mueller report, but Carol and I, in our reporting for this book, learned more vivid details about what happened. The moment when Trump found out that Mueller was appointed special counsel, and he went into one of these rages. He was in the Oval Office. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, Don McGahn, the White House counsel, were there in front of him, telling him that Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, was appointing Mueller as the special counsel. And Trump erupted, and he said, "I'm effed." And he yelled at Jeff Sessions and said it was all his fault because he had recused himself from the Russia investigation and therefore was not protecting the president as the president wanted to be protected by the attorney general. And it was just a very unsettling and chaotic and destructive moment in the Trump presidency that speaks to his inner fear about losing that power.
And you talked to a number of sources who were close to Robert Mueller. Several of them actually said that they saw something change in him over the 2 years of the investigation. Did they explain what they meant by that?
You know, they hinted at it a little bit. We don't, in this book, diagnose Robert Mueller. We don't have professional medical credentials to be able to do so, and we don't interview anybody who does. But we do interview, for the book, a number of Mueller's friends, longtime associates, allies, who described him changing over these last few years, not as sharp, not as with it, sometimes not as present during the investigation. People who worked in the Justice Department in close contact with the special counsel team would describe Mueller as sort of the Wizard of Oz. They knew he was there, but they didn't see him a lot. He would disappear at some of the meetings. There's one scene in the book where Mueller is sitting across the table from Bill Barr, who had just become the attorney general, and he's reading from a piece of paper, and his hands are shaking. And Barr and his deputies at the Justice Department concluded that is not the Bob Mueller we know and remember. And there was some concern about Mueller. Of course, that became public when Mueller testified before Congress, and there's been plenty of commentary about how he appeared physically in that moment.
Right. Right. But I mean, it's understandable. 2 years of this, the stress and probably the loss of sleep would probably take a toll on anyone, I suppose.
Absolutely. And he was also, you know, is up there in years. And so clearly there's an aging component as well.
Well, one of the stories in your book that's gotten the most attention is your account of a meeting between President Trump and his generals at the Pentagon that rapidly devolved into Trump calling them a bunch of babies and losers. How did that meeting come together, and what were Trump's advisors trying to accomplish with that?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked about this meeting because it was a really important inflection point early in the presidency. It was July of 2017, about 6 months in, and Defense Secretary Mattis, Secretary of State Tillerson, Gary Cohn, the economic advisor, they had grown alarmed with the president's lack of knowledge about the world, about geography, about our alliances and military deployments, and so they brought him to a room called the Tank inside the Pentagon. It's the sacred conference room for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is where decisions of war and peace are made. It's considered almost a holy site among the military brass. And Trump comes in and they begin a slideshow presentation to try to teach him, you know, Mr. President, here's where we have military bases around the world. Here's why we have so many troops on the Korean Peninsula to keep us safe. Here's why we prioritize our NATO alliance to keep us safe by partnering with our Western European allies. And the president really recoiled from this. He did not like the tutorial schoolhouse vibe of the session, and he started to bark and bellow at the military commanders who were around him. He said the war in Afghanistan was a loser war. He called them losers for fighting and leading it. He then said, you're a bunch of dopes and babies. And then he said something that was the most scarring thing he could say to this group. He said, I would not go to war with you people.
Which is ironic, considering that he got out of Vietnam with the bone spur, supposedly.
That's correct. And these are people who've worn the uniform to protect our country for decades, who've committed themselves to this line of public service. Wow. And the commander-in-chief is dressing him down. Only one person stood up to the president in that room, and it was Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. And after the meeting, Tillerson said to others in a hallway at the Pentagon that the president was an effing moron. And it was the moment that forever changed the relationship between Trump and Tillerson. And of course, Trump fired Tillerson the next year.
And it's interesting that of all the people in the room, including all of these decorated military generals, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was the only one who spoke up. And indeed, in a number of these meetings, he was the one who spoke up.
Yeah. And, you know, we know from our reporting with sources who were in the room that day that Tillerson was waiting for Mattis to speak up, the Secretary of Defense, to defend the military, and Mattis wouldn't comment. And Tillerson was thinking to himself, gosh darn it, Jim, say something. But he realized, you know what? Mattis is genetically a Marine. He's following the chain of command, and the president outranks the defense secretary, and he was just going along. Another person, by the way, who didn't speak up was Vice President Pence, which was really striking because Pence has a son who was actually deployed in Afghanistan to fight in the military. But Pence was described to us as a wax figure in this meeting, just unwilling to confront the president.
Yeah, of all the people in Trump's inner circle, aside from the family, Pence probably has the most job security, and yet he always is in lockstep with the president. In your research, did you ever come across any instances where he tried to counsel the president against his worst impulses or push back?
None. I wish I could tell you we knew of examples where Pence stood up to the president or tried to steer him in a different direction, but we did not come across any. There certainly are not any publicly that we know about. You know, I will say that Pence's advisors, his aides, will tell you that in private, he counsels the president. He will sometimes challenge what Trump wants done in private. But we've never actually seen evidence of that. That's just what his staff tell reporters.
Did they ever say anything about Trump actually listening to him?
I don't know. You know, if Pence ever confronts Trump, and I say that's an if because, again, we don't have evidence that this has happened, it's in private when they're one-on-one. Pence, in all the meetings that we were privy to with the president in the reporting of this book, Pence was never somebody who stood up to challenge him or to try to correct him or to try to say, no, Mr. President, that's a bad idea. Let's do this instead.
There are several instances of these confrontations with Rex Tillerson. Another one that comes to mind is at some point, I guess, Trump wanted to get rid of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which led to another confrontation. Can you tell us that story?
You know, this was a really surprising discovery for Carol and for me in our reporting when Trump is in the Oval Office and he tells Tillerson, I want you to get rid of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This is a law that's been on the books, mind you, for decades. It protects from corruption abroad. Mm-hmm. And it basically says an American company cannot bribe a foreign official for the purposes of doing business overseas. But Trump told Tillerson that he thinks it's unfair, that it hinders the ability of American businesses to conduct business and win contracts abroad, and that he thinks bribery should be legal. And he instructed Tillerson to get rid of it. And there are a couple problems with that. The first problem being the Secretary of State is not empowered to get rid of a law. We have a separation of power in our country. There's a legislative branch that does the laws. But beyond that, Tillerson just thought it was such a preposterous idea that he said back to the president, you know, sir, that's not – I'm not the guy to do that. Mm-hmm. But Trump didn't quit. He then asked Stephen Miller, his senior policy advisor in the White House, to draft an executive order to try to get rid of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That order, of course, was never signed and never – became anything because that would be illegal to try to repeal a law, an executive order. But nonetheless, it speaks to the president's determination to get rid of that prohibition on foreign foreign corruption and bribery.
Interesting. So, you know, kind of this idea that he is above the law gets projected onto America and the world as a whole, I guess.
Exactly. And as we think about the impeachment trial right now, one of the defenses that the president's lawyers have been making in the Senate is that the president was not trying to withhold the military aid regarding the Bidens. Rather, he was focused on rooting out corruption wherever it exists abroad. He was committed to getting rid of corruption and didn't like bribery and wanted to clean up the world. And it just it does not hold up to the actual facts that we know from our reporting earlier in the presidency.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. What would you do if you knew there was a place to learn step-by-step strategies designed to help you make the right moves inside the financial markets? A place to develop skills that could help you generate income and build confidence toward your retirement goals. At Online Trading Academy, they know how to teach people the skills and knowledge that could empower you to take control of your financial future so you can spend less time worrying about life and more time living it. For over 20 years and across 50 locations worldwide, Online Trading Academy has been teaching people just like you skills designed to help you learn to invest with the confidence of the pros. Start by taking their free introductory class. Visit otatrade.com/kick for 2 free tickets to a class in your area and receive their professional insider's kit with lessons from top instructors just for attending. That's otatrade.com/kick. otatrade.com/kick. Today's episode is also sponsored by Native. Many conventional deodorants contain aluminum, which forms a plug in your sweat glands to keep you from sweating. But Native's deodorant is made without aluminum, so you can feel better about what you're putting on your body while smelling and feeling fresh all day long. Native deodorant is formulated without aluminum, parabens, or talc, and made with ingredients you've actually heard of, like coconut oil and shea butter. It comes in over 10 scents like coconut and vanilla and lavender and rose. Native is also excited for the relaunch of their toothpaste. Native's toothpastes use a special blend of naturally derived cleansers, flavors, and whiteners to deliver a great brushing experience and the same clean mouth feeling you're used to. They offer 2 minty flavors with the option of fluoride or fluoride-free that will help keep your mouth squeaky clean. There's no risk to try because Native offers free shipping on every order and 30-day free returns and exchanges in the USA. I've been wearing Native's eucalyptus and mint deodorant lately. It smells refreshing and natural, the way a deodorant should smell, and it keeps me feeling fresh from early in the morning well into the night. It rolls on dry, and it holds up under pressure, whether I'm running around to meetings or running on the treadmill. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code KICK during checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com and code KICK for 20% off your first purchase. In another meeting of Trump and his generals and advisors that I think took place in the Situation Room, Trump floated the idea of charging Afghanistan and other countries for our military assistance, essentially turning our troops into a mercenary force. He even said that he would like to make a profit off of it. What was the reaction like in the room?
You know, it's funny to joke about because he's a real estate guy and he's thinking about leases and rent. And and he sees here we're giving these countries something, which is troops and bases and military equipment, and they should be paying us rent. But it's such a serious offense to people who are in the military, and the leaders of the military could not believe that he would propose this as the commander-in-chief, as the president, because for years we've had military members and bases all around the world for the sole purpose of keeping us safe. You know, if we have tens of thousands of troops in the Korean Peninsula, they're not there only to help South Korea and Japan. They're there to protect us, America, from North Korea, which has nuclear ambitions and is a clear adversary and a threat to our country. And so Tillerson was one of the people who confronted the president on this idea of making money off of the soldiers and troops abroad, and basically said, you know, Mr. President, people do not join the military to make money or to make a profit or to become soldiers of fortune. They do it because they're patriots and they're trying to keep us safe.
Now, Trump had praised Rex Tillerson as this brilliant businessman and this man of the world when he appointed him, but things seemed to have devolved fairly quickly. What was the turning point in that relationship?
You know, Trump hired Tillerson without a ton of vetting. And that's not to say Tillerson had a controversial past, but more that Trump didn't quite know what he was getting when he hired Rex Tillerson. He thought, this guy's CEO of Exxon. He's got gravitas. He walks into the room and everybody stands at attention and listens to what he has to say. And he wanted that guy as his Secretary of State. But he didn't really consider that Tillerson has a completely different worldview and was interested in protecting the Western alliance and was interested in upholding some of the American values that were enshrined for decades now and protecting the world order established after World War II. And so they began to clash over disagreements about NATO, about the Paris Climate Accord, about other things that flared up in those early months. But it really became strained when NBC reported in the fall of 2017 that Tillerson had called the president an effing moron.
Yeah.
That was just a bridge too far for the president. They became very tense for the next several months. Yeah. And actually, Trump will remember, fired Tillerson effectively by tweet in March of 2018 while Tillerson was in Africa. A little bit of trivia here. What Tillerson was in Africa for was a diplomatic mission to try to ease tensions with African leaders because Trump had so offended African leaders by calling their countries S-hole nations.
And just to add insult to injury, shortly thereafter, I think Trump or one of his advisors put it out there that I guess Rex Tillerson had some kind of a stomach virus that he caught in Africa and was
Montezuma's revenge
on the toilet when he got fired.
Yeah. And you know what? He actually did have a bit of a bug, an illness from the travel, but it was not Montezuma's revenge, which is the phrase that John Kelly had used to describe Tillerson's illness.
Right,
and he was not actually on the toilet when he got the call from Kelly.
Right. But it really highlights how in the Trump administration, you don't just get fired. You get humiliated. No one seems to exit unscathed unless perhaps Nikki Haley, I guess, maybe one of the only ones.
That's exactly right. And there are so many moments of humiliation and abusive management in this book, including H.R. McMaster, the president's national security advisor, former national security advisor. You know, Trump hated when McMaster would come brief him about national security matters and intelligence because he thought McMaster was too lecturing, too professorial. And so when McMaster would come into the Oval Office to give a briefing and there are other officials in the room, Trump would make fun of him and say, puff up his chest and sort of mockingly say, "I am General McMaster, here to give your briefing, sir," and just teased him like a schoolyard bully. And, you know, you have to remember, this is not just the national security advisor for the country, but a three-star lieutenant general of the Army, one of the most highly regarded military intellectuals in our country, being mocked by the president of the United States because he couldn't tolerate, didn't have a patience for the briefings he was giving.
Yeah, and I think that you said that McMaster actually had to use some little tricks to keep Trump's attention or to get him to pay attention to either the PDB or the personal briefing.
Yeah, the tricks, you know, Trump wouldn't read the briefing materials, the daily presidential brief with all the nation's intelligence. It's the most sensitive document, by the way, that our government produces for the president. Then he wouldn't read the 3-page summary. Then he wouldn't read the 1-page summary. And so Tillerson and others in the White House finally had to give him note cards with just the bullet points of the most important material because it was all the president had the patience to read.
What kind of words and visuals get Trump's attention, either in that daily briefing or the meetings at the Pentagon and that sort of thing?
You know, he likes graphics. He likes maps, videos, photos. He loves dollar signs. He's a real estate guy. He loves to see dollar signs. And most of all, he loves to see his own name.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of his military leaders would add Trump to the slideshow presentation, just have his name there, and it would capture his attention a little more.
Gee whiz. The difference between Pence and Tillerson sort of highlights what Trump looks for in his team. They don't have to necessarily be smart. They're not valued for their experience or counsel. But above all else, they have to be loyal. It's something that I read throughout this book. Every time he has a vacancy to fill, he has this obsession with loyalty, not to the country or to the office of the president, but personal loyalty to Donald Trump. Has that served him very well?
You know, I would leave it to others to evaluate whether it served him well, and certainly we'll get an indication of that in November when the American people have a say about whether he gets a second term in office. But you're absolutely right about the loyalty. That has been the North Star in the Trump administration. And, you know, every president demands loyalty to some degree from the people who work for him or her. Mm. But with President Trump, it's not just loyalty to the country. It's loyalty to Trump, the man, the brand, mm-hmm. the legend, the self-image. It's all about who's fluffing me up, who's defending me publicly, who's lying on my behalf. And if you betray him in his estimation, you're out. There's no tolerance for betrayal.
Yeah. One senior official likens working in the White House right now to playing whack-a-mole. Was that a common theme among the sources you talked to?
It was. You know, it was especially prevalent early on in the first year or so, where advisors and cabinet secretaries would scramble day in and day out to try to put out fires to prevent disasters from happening. You know, it's a little bit more orderly now, but not entirely. And I believe from our reporting that the White House remains sort of a den of dysfunction. There's chaos everywhere, but Trump actually likes the chaos. He thinks he thrives on the chaos. Huh. And important to keep in mind, many Trump voters, tens of millions of them around the country, think that this disruptive force and this chaotic energy is actually really good for our country mm-hmm. because they feel like the establishment, the norms, the ways of Washington have simply not worked for many decades, and Trump is finally in there, the bull in the china shop, tearing everything up.
Yeah.
And in their view, he's their champion.
Yeah, the thing that I always wonder is, does Donald Trump not understand that the people who work for him, they're not out to undermine him, they're not trying to screw him? Their job is to help this president succeed at his mission.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised that point because, you know, I don't want readers or listeners to the podcast to think that all the people in this book are out to get Trump. They're actually mostly Republicans.
Right.
They're conservatives who joined the administration in a political capacity because they wanted to work for Donald Trump and they wanted the Trump presidency to be a successful presidency. They are describing the horror show that they experienced to us in this book, but they joined because they were loyal to him and because they wanted him to succeed. These are not Democrats trashing him for partisan purposes.
Right. And yet Trump seems to have this disdain for knowledge and experience, and he has a troubling obsession with some supposed deep state trying to undermine him. Did you find evidence that maybe even other world leaders have tried to use Trump's paranoia and disregard for his advisors to manipulate him?
Certainly, other world leaders have tried to manipulate him. First and foremost, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. You know, Trump's obsession with Putin is a through line in the narrative of our book. Before he even took office, Trump was asking Reince Priebus, who was set to become the White House chief of staff, when can I meet Putin? Can we meet before the inauguration? Priebus, of course, had to explain, you know, no, sir. There's only one president at a time in the U.S. Obama is still the president. It would be inappropriate for you, the president-elect, to meet with Putin. But besides that, we need to meet with our NATO allies first. But Trump, you know, despite so many advisors trying to teach him about Putin, the former KGB agent, the master manipulator, the Machiavellian leader who's trying to poke holes at America and undercut America, they tried to convince Trump to beware of Putin, to not trust Putin, to view Putin as an adversary. And Trump tuned it all out. He wanted to be friends with Putin. And we, of course, saw in Helsinki, Finland, and I was there covering that trip in the summer of 2018, where the president refused to believe American intelligence conclusions about Russia's efforts and campaign to interfere in the 2016 election to help Trump win, and in fact said that he believed Putin's very strong denial. Right. And that was a moment where Putin really, really won one over the president of the United States.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like Putin sort of knows how to speak Trump's language of personal diplomacy, because I think at one point in the book, Putin is saying, look, don't listen to these people around you. They're not rooting for you. If you can just ignore them, you and I can have a personal relationship and we
That's
can get
right.
things done.
That's right. That was a really important moment, and I think speaks to the way Putin has been able to communicate directly with Trump to undermine the advisors around the president and to capture Trump's attention and really manipulate him at his core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think at some point in here you talk about how his advisors coach Trump, and then there's this inevitable moment of anxiety whenever Trump goes into a room with a world leader one-on-one. A good example of this is his meeting with India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. And in that case, I guess it had real consequences for America's influence in the region. Tell us a little about what happened there.
So this is the first time Trump met Modi, the Prime Minister of India. They were at an international summit, I believe, in the Philippines on this trip. And, you know, they're getting to know each other. And Modi is trying to feel out this new American administration. Is this a country that should be an important, a growing trade ally with? Should India rely on the U.S. for support? It's a very complicated geopolitical situation for India. And Trump seemed to not really understand India's role and India's priorities. And then it became clear he didn't even understand India's geography and made a comment to Modi about, you know, don't worry so much about China. At least you don't have China on your border. Well, China is on India's border and is a huge threat to India, both from an economic perspective and from a military and security perspective. And Modi, as it was described to us by people who witnessed this, his eyes bulged out in surprise. He couldn't believe it. He made eye contact with the Secretary of State at the time to express disbelief. And in the months that followed, India pulled back and Modi just decided, you know what, I'm not going to get too close to this new American president. It doesn't seem very secure. Fast forward, of course, to right now, and Modi is pretty friendly with Trump. Modi actually visited Houston, Texas a few months back. I was at this massive rally in Houston of Indian Americans, and they appeared on stage together, and Modi sang Trump's praises. And so the relationship has certainly warmed since that initial meeting. But it was a moment early on when there was genuine concern that Trump's ignorance and lack of understanding of a foreign leader could really harm the relationship between the two countries.
Yeah. And yet Trump seems to think that he is a master diplomat. Is it true that at one point he was actually calling up heads of state and campaigning for the Nobel Prize?
That is true, if you can believe it. You know, Trump thought Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize in his first year as president. He was awarded the Nobel. If he can get it, I should get it. And Trump thought he had accomplished so many historic things as president in the United States that he should be awarded the Nobel. And he started a campaign to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He called up the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the very same day that Michael Cohen was pleading guilty in New York in a federal criminal investigation. And, you know, Trump was focused on winning the Nobel. And he not only wanted to wanted to get himself nominated for the Nobel, which, by the way, has not happened. He has not been awarded that prize. But he also contemplated with his advisors awarding himself the Presidential Medal of Freedom because he thought he had been such a historic, patriotic figure as president.
My God. Is it fair to say that Trump has now banished all of the adults in the room, or is there anyone in the White House who's still performing that role?
You know, most of the people that we think of as those human guardrails, the people like John Kelly and Jim Mattis and to some degree Reince Priebus and Rex Tillerson, they're all gone. I hesitate to say there are no adults in the room left because certainly among the president's advisors, there are people who, you know, will exercise some judgment to prevent a calamity from happening, for example. But by and large, the people who are around the president now are there to try to enable him and to try to get to a yes, to execute what he wants done. Mike Pompeo, a very different Secretary of State than Rex Tillerson in that he's willing to toe the line with Trump and execute Trump's agenda. Mick Mulvaney, a very different chief of staff than John Kelly, he's there to get everything done that the president wants done and to not stand in the way of it. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, why Pompeo and Mulvaney are now caught up in the impeachment inquiry and implicated in the wrongdoing with regards to Ukraine and the military aid.
And of course, Mulvaney is now, after impeachment, headed to a disgraceful exit from the White House. I have to wonder, you know, apparently in the book you say that he really campaigned for the job of chief of staff. And I wonder why. I mean, who would wish that on themselves after watching what happened to Priebus and Kelly? I mean, there's a certain amount of madness there, isn't there? I mean, he's like a woman who dates a bad boy and keeps telling herself, I'm going to be the one to change him.
That's just one way to talk about it. And by the way, I don't know, for example, that Mulvaney is necessarily on the outs, but certainly we've been reporting for some time now that he's not long for this world. And after we get through impeachment, Trump may get rid of Mulvaney. But we don't know that that for sure is going to happen. But to your question about Mulvaney, he wanted the job because it's one of the most powerful positions in all of Washington. Mulvaney, Republican Tea Party congressman from South Carolina. It's a lot better to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget than to be a random House member. And so he took that job as OMB director in the first year of the Trump presidency. And then the opportunity to be chief of staff is so great. Mulvaney aspires to a future beyond the Trump administration. And so that's a credential that he probably calculated could help him get a good job down the road, could help him with speaking appearances or to make some income or whatever he has in mind. But it's a powerful position. So it's understandable he would want it, even though, you know, he'd be serving Trump.
Yeah, you also say that President Trump really wanted Chris Christie to be the one to replace John Kelly as chief of staff. Why did Christie say no?
You know, this was in at the end of 2018 when Kelly was on the outs, and Trump actually offered Christie the job of chief of staff, and Christie had to think about it and then ultimately said no. And there are a couple reasons for it. One is Christie had published a memoir, which was set to be was set to come out in January, a month later. And he knew, Christie knew, that the memoir was going to be devastating in its portrayal of Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. Remember, Christie, as the U.S. attorney in New Jersey a decade earlier, had put Kushner's father in prison.
So
there's a lot of bad blood between Christie and the Kushner family. And Christie ultimately calculated he couldn't work as the White House chief of staff if Jared is right down the hall as the senior advisor. But there may have been other calculations on Christie's mind as well. He's, by the way, had a successful run as a television commentator. He's making a lot more money than he would have in the White House. And he remains close to the president and can call him at any moment if he needs to. And so I think that's a pretty comfortable life for Chris Christie.
In the epilogue, you say that the question wasn't did Trump do wrong, but would someone enforce the Constitution? And you compare the current moment to the Nixon impeachment and the Republicans of conscience who stepped forward and put the country first. Were you hoping that something about that might resonate with some Republicans weighing impeachment in the Senate right now? And are you disappointed by how this impeachment has played out largely along party lines?
You know, it's a good question. Carol and I are journalists, and we're not here to advocate for any particular outcome politically. Our role in this book was to unearth the truth of what was really happening behind the scenes and to share it with readers. And the way we wrote that epilogue was actually pretty careful. We wanted to lay out the choice that Republicans in Congress and specifically in the Senate were ultimately going to have to make, which is the choice that they're making right now about whether to convict or acquit the president in the impeachment trial. We're not rooting for any particular outcome. Rather, we're just explaining the thought process, what they were grappling with when they're thinking about their historical legacies coupled with the political pressures of the moment.
Well, I mentioned in the opening that you are the White House bureau chief for The Washington Post. What's your job been like in the wake of this book release? Has that relationship changed at all?
You know, no. I continue to do my job. I've not been reporting as much day to day the last couple of weeks because we're talking to people like you and getting the word out about the book. But, you know, I will continue to cover this administration and to do it fairly and comprehensively and aggressively. And I think that's been a hallmark of The Washington Post's coverage of the Trump presidency throughout, certainly a hallmark of my own coverage. And that's not going to change going forward.
Yeah. And yet Trump called you out on Twitter. Apparently he called you and your co-author two stone cold losers from the Amazon Washington Post. When Trump hate tweets you, you kind of know that you're doing something right. Did you find anything about that weirdly validating?
You know, I'm glad he paid attention to the book.
Okay.
And by the way, our reporting in the last few weeks suggests that he's very upset with the title of the book and specifically with the red eyes that are on the cover. He thinks that is not a flattering image and is upset that the book is being is presented in that fashion. But setting that aside, I mean, look, we knew that a book like this would probably get under the president's skin, and that's fine. He can say what he wants to say about our book and about our reporting, but I can tell you We don't see ourselves, Carol and I both don't see ourselves as at war with the president. Mm-hmm. We're not here to tear him down or to ensure his defeat. We're here to inform the public about what he's doing and what the people around him say about what he's doing.
Yeah.
And that's our job. We're just at work and we're going to keep our heads down and keep working.
Yeah. And it's amazing that he would be upset at you for using a title that is from his own words.
I think he certainly is aware that he created that phrase. He should take credit for it.
Well, once again, the book is called A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Philip Rucker, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again to Phil Rucker for coming on the podcast. Order A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. You can read Phil in The Washington Post and follow him on Twitter at Philip Rucker. Online Trading Academy knows how to teach people the skills and knowledge that could empower you to take control of your financial future. Start by taking their free introductory class. Visit otatrade.com/kick. for two free tickets to a class in your area, and receive their Professional Insiders Kit with lessons from top instructors just for attending. That's otatrade.com/kick. One more time, otatrade.com/kick. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.